service.
The 27 Club is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Elvis. Janis Joplin died at the age of 27, and she lived a life where the highs mingled closely with the lows. I can give you 27 reasons why that statement is true. 11 would be the number on a scale of 1 to 10 that she would turn her performance level up to while on stage performing, especially when she was joined by a good friend like Ron Pigpen McKernan. Another one would be the number of performances by a certain rabble-rousing rock band in Detroit that would make her suddenly feel like a woman out of time. 10 more would be the number of jaws of San Francisco musicians that hit the floor when news of Big Brother and the holding company's unprecedented deal with Columbia Records hit the wires. Another 3 would be the early hour of the morning when she stepped into an elevator at the Chelsea Hotel, only to have fate intervene in the form of an unexpected passenger. And 2 would be the number of years she would have left to live after she sat her band down and told them that she would be leaving to pursue a solo career. All totaling 27. On this, our 7th episode of Season 3, Rabble Rousing, Jaws on the Floor, Early Morning Elevator Rides, and Janis Joplin Walking a Winding Path to Liberation. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. Detroit, Michigan, March 1968. The air in the grand ballroom was electric. The stage was set. Lights dimmed. The room balanced on edge. The edge peered into a chasm, and in the chasm was something that no one had seen or felt before. Something new. A revolution. People in the audience weren't restless. They were tense. Every second felt like a minute. Every minute like an hour. Cigarette smoke hung in suspension as if it, too, was waiting for something to happen before it faded into thin air. A guy in dark aviator sunglasses and a black leather jacket that read Zenta on the back in huge letters was pacing the stage. He took the electric air, the edge of the chasm, the suspended cigarette smoke, took it all in as fuel. He put it in his legs, which were in constant motion. He put it all in his hands, which he flexed and clenched and crackled knuckles. Janis Joplin stood to the side of the stage, bottle in one hand, half-smoked butt in the other, and she felt the collective tension. She had goosebumps on her arms. "Who is this guy?" she asked the promoter standing next to her, and motioned to the guy pacing the stage. "Is he in the band?" The promoter shook his head. "Nah, that's J.C. Crawford. He's the band's spiritual advisor." And here Janis thought that Big Brother was bringing the enlightenment to the unsuspecting masses in Detroit. But the crowd in Detroit didn't know Big Brother from Adam. The crowd was there for the openers, the band from up the road in Lincoln Park that was about to set shit off. The guy on stage finally stopped pacing and wrapped his hands around the microphone. The band walked on stage and turned their amplifiers on, and Janis could feel the hum of the amp's tubes in her bones. She felt the collective tension in the room swell up. It was practically unbearable. And then the guy started to rap with the audience. It was a church sermon and a political rally wrapped in one, scored by the electric breath of the band's amplifiers, switched on and ready to pounce.
"Brothers and sisters, I want to see your hands. I want everybody to kick up some noise. I want to hear some revolution out there. Brothers and sisters, the time has come for each and every one of you to decide whether you are going to be the problem or whether you are going to be the solution. You must choose, brothers, you must choose. Brothers, it's time to testify, and I want to know, are you ready to testify? Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the MC5.
The music started and it was like a bomb went off. Fuck, Janis thought. The MC5 played far outside her comfort zone. She didn't even know what zone they were in. Big Brother was yesterday and the MC5 were tomorrow. But maybe right now Albert Grossman was right. Maybe Big Brother was holding her back. But when the MC5 finished their set, There was only one thing Janice could say when it was time for Big Brother to headline the night. No fucking way. In March of 68, Big Brother and the holding company were on tour again. Detroit wasn't intended to be just another show, but a recording session. Albert Grossman had finally come through on his promise to sweet-talk Clive Davis, and Big Brother was part of the Columbia family. And the deal was all anyone was talking about out west. Columbia wound up paying a small fortune for the band. First, Davis had to pay Bob Shad $200,000 to release the group from their mainstream records contract. Next, Shad would pocket a 2% royalty from the group's first two records on Columbia. And then, Davis ponied up a $50,000 advance to cover costs for the new record. The totality of the deal eclipsed any other deal for any other Bay Area band in 1968. And the high of the deal was quickly undermined by the lows they felt on the tour. New York City was way too uptight. $5,000 worth of gear was stolen after their show at the Psychedelic Supermarket in Boston. In Detroit, the plan was to record their shows for the Columbia record, a live album. And the studio fell short when it came to capturing their raw live sound. The best place to witness Big Brother was in their natural habitat, sweaty and breathless under bright stage lights and feeding off of an audience's approving roar. If you couldn't be there, then a recorded document would be the next best thing. But they weren't prepared for what was happening in Detroit. The MC5 shook them right down to the core. The MC5 showed them what true badass motherfuckers looked like, regardless of how many zeros your record deal had on it. The MC5 called for a, quote, total assault on the culture by any means necessary, and that included rock and roll, dope, and fucking in the streets. They were associates of the White Panthers, an anti-racist political collective co-founded by their manager John Sinclair, and heavily influenced by Fred Hampton and Huey Newton of the Black Panthers. They were strip-searched at shows, their phone lines were tapped, they endured routine visits from G-Men. They said motherfucker on their debut album and then called for a boycott of the stores that wouldn't carry it. Here was Big Brother, getting the shakedown in San Fran for playing too loud and smoking too much grass. And then there was the MC5, turning the whole fucking system upside down. Later that summer, the Democratic National Convention would be held at Grant Park in Chicago, and a full lineup of contemporary rock and roll was scheduled. The Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, Big Brother and the Holding Company, and the MC5. Big Brother bailed at the last minute. The other groups followed. The MC5 was the only band that showed up. The DNC's whole vibe was off. Something was going to go down, and it wouldn't be pretty. Janice could feel it. She knew it deep down. She thought back to the show they played with the MC5 at the Grand Ballroom in March about how, in the wrong scenario, that sort of performance would be like a bad trip truth bomb. And she was right. The MC5's raucous performance was nearly eclipsed by the sound of 10,000 anti-war demonstrators chanting at a wall of National Guardsmen, and then by the sound of Chicago police helicopters circling overhead, and then by the sound of demonstrators being hit with tear gas canisters and billy clubs. Back on that March night in Detroit, Big Brother finally took the stage following the MC5's opening set. The reel-to-reel was rolling on the mobile recording unit, and they didn't bring it at all. There was no revolution in their sound, no liberation. Janice listened to the playback afterwards and stormed off in frustration. They would have to try again another night, in another city. Preferably not one where their preconceptions about rock and roll would be burned to the ground in front of them by the opening band. And Janice knew what city they'd be in next, and the night after next, and then the night after that. The tour sheet told her that. She didn't know how they'd sound, though, or what they'd find when they shifted from one time zone to another. You just never knew. Sometimes the elevator door would open up and the plot would twist, and then the elevator door would close and the plot would twist again, or where it would wind up. Janice didn't know. She knew she wasn't prepared. Janice Joplin stepped into the elevator at the Chelsea Hotel on West 23rd Street in New York City, only to find that the lift wasn't empty after all. He was standing in the corner, adjacent to the buttons, tucked out of sight. He looked like a professor who had been up all night grading papers and nursing a bottomless old-fashioned. It was spring, 1968, 3 a.m. Time was nothing but a number to the Chelsea Hotel. The venerable institution was a favorite of artists who favored unorthodox hours and unorthodox desires. Mark Twain was a guest, as was Charles Bukowski. William Burroughs, Jackson Pollock, Arthur Miller, Arthur C. Clarke wrote 2001, A Space Odyssey in one of the Chelsea rooms. Jack Kerouac wrote On the Road in another. Dylan Thomas entered the coma that would end his life there in 1953. And decades later, in 1978, Sid Vicious's girlfriend, Nancy Spungen, was found dead in the bathroom of suite number 100. Janice and Big Brother were in New York City to begin their new but fatefully short-lived time with Albert Grossman, Clive Davis, and Columbia Records. They had begun recording at Columbia's New York studios, and the tour that would take them to Janice's eye-opening moment in Detroit was about to start. The Chelsea Hotel was as good of a home base for Janice as anywhere. She had the man in the elevator made within seconds of stepping inside. She knew exactly who he was. But he looked at her with the look of late-night lust, the kind of leer that would get others in trouble, but for him, led to more sexual conquests than he could count on 2 hands and 2 feet. His leer was driven by his ego, which told him he could ball whomever he wanted, even a stranger in an elevator at 3 a.m. His ego also told him that this stranger had no idea who he was, that celebrity meant nothing, that all there was this moment, this look, these people, a man, a woman, and the unspoken chemistry in this 6x7 box. "Good evening, miss," he said, his voice low, paced like a turtle and not the hare. "Are you looking for someone?" She responded that she was looking for Kris Kristofferson. "Little lady, you are in luck," the man responded, "because I am Kris Kristofferson." Hold up. That was his version of the encounter, Leonard Cohen's. Leonard Cohen had his own version of all of his encounters. He'd tell this romanticized story on stage years later, when he introduced the song Chelsea Hotel No. 2, which he wrote about this very night and this very encounter, about the night that he slept with Janis Joplin in the Chelsea Hotel. But that wasn't exactly how it all went down. Janis's memory wasn't so poetic. First of all, she hadn't met Kris Kristofferson yet. Hadn't even heard of the guy, so why she would be saying his name in a Chelsea Hotel lift in 1968 was anyone's guess. Second, Leonard was in a much gloomier state than he let on. He was in his early 30s and he had bailed on a poet's life in his native Canada to try his hand at being a singer-songwriter in America. It wasn't going so well. Rolling Stone said that his debut album, Songs of Leonard Cohen, had 3 brilliant songs, 1 good one, 3 qualified bummers, and 3 flaming shits. That last part ate him up. He was depressed. He took a walk and ate his feelings in the form of a greasy cheeseburger at Bronco Burger. Got a drink at a bar, tried to pick up chicks, but kind of did it half-assed, as glum and bummed out as he was, and then went back to his hotel, head hanging low. When Janice ran into him in the elevator, she knew exactly who he was. He was on her fucking record label, for Christ's sakes. She was recording the new Big Brother album in the same studio Leonard had cut his lukewarm received debut. She also knew exactly the kind of night he was having. She'd been there, done that. He wanted to pretend that he didn't know who she was. That was fine, but she was no groupie. She was the one in charge here. She was the one who asked him what floor he was staying on. And when she found out they were both on the 4th floor, asked him to come to her room. She'd later all but forget about the night because it was so forgettable. There was no passion, no spark. She had some better late night trysts at the Chelsea though, including one with a member of the Chambers Brothers. And that was after a show they played with Jimi Hendrix. The show crashed by Jim Morrison, the show where Janice had to put an end to Morrison's drunken hijinks by bringing a liquor bottle down on his head. Men. Goddamn men. Men could be so goddamn groovy 1 minute and then so disappointing the next. Joe McDonald was an exception to the rule. But even that was a relationship that was doomed from the start. They called him Country Joe, aka leader of Country Joe and the Fish, a psychedelic band out of Berkeley. He was recently divorced, on the rebound, and was mesmerized by Janice's voice and humor. But Joe liked singing protest music and dropping LSD tabs. Janice liked booze, was continuing to develop a taste for heroin, and wasn't interested in living a life of rallies and protests. All Joe wanted to talk about was the Vietnam War, ergo doomed from the start. There were more men to follow, whether it was Ron Pigpen McKernan, Chris Christopherson at long last, or David Nyhaus later on in Rio. And there was also Seth Morgan, the man she would wind up engaged to, although no one in her life knew much about him, let alone their engagement. They met when he delivered coke to her house one afternoon. They kept the relationship on the down low, real hush-hush. So hush-hush that many of her close friends would have a lot of questions for Seth Morgan when Janis didn't show up as scheduled at a recording session in October 1970. And then, there was the time in late 1967 when Janis woke up one morning feeling sick. It was a different kind of sick than the kind she was used to, the kind she'd experience after drinking too much or when she needed a fix. She was pregnant. She wasn't 100% sure of the father, but she assumed it was Paul Wally, the drummer for Blue Cheer, a heavy San Francisco rock trio that she had spent some nights with. Paul had skipped town and no one knew where he was. Janis made the difficult decision to get an abortion. She knew she wasn't fit to be a mother. Not now. Maybe not ever. Roe v. Wade was still years away, however, and abortions weren't an option in the States. She drove herself to Mexico for the procedure, which turned out to be a botched one as she was hemorrhaging days later after she returned. Sometimes you're with someone and you're convinced that they have something to tell you, she later said, looking back on her relationships with all these men and more. And maybe nothing's really happening, but you keep telling yourself something's happening, so you keep showing up. You keep pulling, giving, rapping, and then all of a sudden, about 4 o'clock in the morning, you realize that this motherfucker is just lying there. She could have been talking about Leonard Cohen or Jim Morrison or Joe McDonald or Paul Wally, or she could have been talking about her band. Big Brother in the Holding Company was just lying there, and Janis Joplin was ready to move on.
We'll be right back after this
word.
She knew it was a dream, because in it, the Southern Comfort tasted like tang. She was on the back of a Harley. Pigpen was driving. She always thought the Pigpen looked like one of the Hell's Angels. When she first met him, she thought he was. He was wearing a paisley bandana around his head. His goatee was going rogue on his face, and his jean jacket was littered with pins and buttons. The wind blew Pig's hair back as he opened the throttle and the bike pressed on down the road. Janis looked in the bike's tiny rearview mirror to see Pig's face, but his windswept hair was in the way. She reached her arms forward and pulled his hair out of his face, but it wasn't Pig's face she saw in the mirror. It was Jay Whitaker's face. And the road was wet. The sky was dark. Every time they drove past the streetlight, the face in the rearview mirror was illuminated for a split second. And every time, it was someone different, but not Pig. The face was Peter DeBlanc's. The face was Chet Helms. The face was Jim Morrison's. He actually looked more like his boozed up pal Jimbo. He cracked a devilish smile. And the face was her father's. But when the Harley came to a stop at the intersection of Haight and Ashbury, Janis hopped off the back. Pig was gone. And the driver was now one of the shadow people she had once seen skulking around Venice Beach. He kicked the stand down and propped the bike up in the middle of the intersection. He held out his hand at Janis, flat, palm up, and stood there, waiting for something. She had nothing to give him. And then, he was gone. The city was empty. There were no musicians or beatniks, no diggers or head shop proprietors, no hippies or freaks or merry pranksters. Janis pulled the bottle of Southern Comfort from her back pocket, twisted the cap off, and took a swig. She twisted her face up. It still tasted like tang. She screwed the cap back on, waited for 5 seconds, twisted it off again, and took another pull. Still, fucking tang. Insanity, she thought. This is insanity. To keep doing something and expecting it to somehow be suddenly different. To think that her booze would suddenly taste like booze and not like some orange-adjacent spaceman juice. She stuffed the bottle in the back pocket of her bell-bottoms and walked to the first door she saw. It was the entrance to the psychedelic shop. She opened the door and stepped inside. But inside wasn't the inside of the psychedelic shop. It was the ranch in Olema where Quicksilver Messenger Service lived communally. Everyone referred to them as Quicksilver Consumer Service because they were on a non-stop diet of dope. Typically, Quicksilver's place was bustling with activity, unless they were all over at the Dead's compound or Big Brother's spot in nearby Lagunitas. But it was dead quiet. Janis called out, but there was no response, no signs of life. And she could hear the waves crashing on the shore in the distance. They were rhythmic and soothing. She walked down a dirt road surrounded on both sides by rows of eucalyptus trees. The trees towered over her and provided shade from the sun. She could hear them wrinkle and crackle as the wind blew. Soon she found herself at the entrance to the Vedanta Society's spiritual retreat. She thought of the MC5 spiritual advisor. She heard his voice ring out throughout the calm of the distinctly Californian geography. Somewhere, a bell tolled. And there were more trees now. And though these were bent over her like a deformed canopy, they were covered in moss. Long, translucent wisps hung from the thick branches. She had felt a calmness up until now. And now, something unsettling took up space in the pit of her stomach. The wind kicked up and the translucent wisps swung back and forth in the breeze. She heard voices coming from the Vedanta Society's place in the big white two-story house up the road. The voices hummed in unison, and there were no words. She thought the sound of the other human voices would provide some sort of comfort. They just made her feel increasingly uneasy. Soon, the rumble of a motorcycle could be heard in the distance. It was getting closer. Janice hoped it was Pig again. And really Pig this time, and not any of the other people that Pig had morphed into earlier. She could see a small cloud of dust down the dirt road where the bike was. The rumble of the engine got louder and the bike got closer. She realized now that it wasn't Pig on the bike. The Harley was painted gold, orange flames were drawn on either side, and Janice noticed the rider's tattoos as he got closer. A sun on one arm, a scorpion on the other. He had short hair, thick mutton chops on the sides of his face. He wasn't wearing sunglasses and his eyes were nearly squinted shut from the sun. She had never seen him before. Not in real life, not in any other dreams. He was a stranger. He slowed down and motioned to Janice to get on the bike. And the pit in her stomach quickly faded away as she climbed onto the back seat. When she woke up, she could hear the rain coming down hard outside. The room was pitch black. She started to piece together the parts of her dream, but like most of her dreams, it was already fading from memory when she awoke. And the last part stuck with her, the stranger on the bike that she had never seen before. Lying awake in the middle of the night after a strange dream, she wasn't in the mood for a stranger. She reached over in the bed and her hands found Pigpen, the deadhead she loved the most, laying next to her. He was passed out. And they were in Pig's room at the dead's compound in Marin County. The two had been up late, drinking Thunderbird and Southern Comfort. And the Southern Comfort did not taste like Tang. The more they drank, the looser they got, and the looser they got, the more they felt a deep connection with each other. Unlike the other members of the dead, Pigpen would rather take long pulls of a bottle than drop doses of Owsley's finest. Like Janice, Pigpen loved the blues, and the older the blues, the better. They were two old souls. They made a racket in Pig's room, which was right above Phil Lesh's room. Phil would hit his ceiling with a broom handle, with the intimate noises got to be too much. A year later, Janice would join the dead on stage at the Fillmore. She would duet with Pig on one of those blues songs they loved, Bobby Blue Bland's Turn On Your Love Light. As their voices commingled in ragged unison, Janice thought back to that night, waking up in Pig's room, the rain pounding outside, the dream lifting like fog on a San Francisco morning, and how it gave her comfort to reach over and feel him next to her. She looked over at Pigpen standing next to her on the stage, her eyes staring directly into his, the band picking up momentum as the song came around to a refrain. And the stage lights changed colors from white to red to green and black to white again. And each time they changed, suddenly, Pig's face changed with them, like it had in the dream. Pig was Jay, and then Pig was Peter, and then Pig was her father. And Janice closed her eyes tight, twisted her voice up with Pig's in their alley cat harmony, and reached out for his hand to ground her. On stage, in front of thousands, she couldn't help but feel totally alone. August 1968. Minneapolis, Minnesota. Peter Albin was thinking of the sweater incident at Mother Blues in Chicago years earlier when he decided he'd had enough of Janis Joplin. He was all bent out of shape then, and he was still bent out of shape now. At some point in between, he had allowed himself to be bent back into shape, and he regretted that. It made him seem weak. Janice had ditched him. They all ditched him, actually, after a recent gig to go shoot up with a bunch of junkies in some house somewhere. Fuck if he knew where. And fuck if he knew where Janice drove her Porsche 356 around town, painted an eye-catching psychedelic design while the rest of them just lived like fucking paupers that they were. Supporting players for this rock and roll goddess, even though they were a democracy, a band of five, supposedly. A band of five. No one was above anyone else, or at least that's what they had told the press early on. Obviously, things had changed. They were on stage at the Guthrie Theater when Peter lost it. He humiliated Janice, told her she sounded like Lassie, the way she was dancing around and was all out of breath every time she came back to the microphone to sing. Janice told Peter to fuck off, just as he expected she would. Hell, if she had a bottle of something hanging around, she probably would have tossed that at his head, too. Later, he regretted what he said. He realized that he had let his anger and his sadness get to him. But it was true. Peter felt betrayed. Janice had made the announcement to leave Big Brother. She wanted a band to lift her up to the next level, and she felt that Big Brother was not that band. Albert Grossman knew that Big Brother was not that band. So she told the boys at the band meeting in August 1968 that she would be leaving at the end of the year, just a few months away. They all knew that their career, as they knew it, was DOA. Even worse, Sam Andrew told the group that he was going with Janice. That may have stung a little more, to be honest. They all knew that Janice's day would come, that she would move on. But Sam's decision made the whole situation seem like an us and them split. And they had just gotten their shit together, too. A big industry deal, a big manager, a big label, a big record. When Cheap Thrills was released in August 1968, it sold so many advanced copies that it had already gone gold by the time it shipped. That's 500,000 copies. Soon after it hit store shelves, it topped the Billboard charts and sold upwards of a million copies. It wasn't exactly a live album as had been intended. The live performances were tough to capture, and the album's producer, John Simon, built a makeshift stage in the studio so that they could have complete control over the process and still replicate the feel of a live show, though only one of the album's seven songs was actually taken from a live show. Rock critic Dean Robert Christgau ranked it the third best album of 1968, behind Dylan's John Wesley Harding and the Byrds' Notorious Byrd Brothers. Other critics weren't so flattering. The New York Times called out Big Brother as middle-class white kids with long blonde hair pretending to be black, and said the record was a bad parody. Downbeat panned it as quote-unquote embarrassing blackface. Mick Jagger himself, an acolyte of black American music and R&B, said, "If I want to listen to a black singer, I'll listen to a black singer." Janice put the blinders on and moved forward. She was busy assembling a new crew. And the musicians would rise up to meet her, far above where Big Brother were operating. Albert Grossman wanted her new band to sound like the Muscle Shoals sound, the greasy R&B rock hybrid that had propelled Aretha Franklin's career making hits, not to mention Etta James's Tell Mama. Skip Prokop, a Canadian drummer who played with the Poppers, one of Grossman's clients, had been tapped to put together Janice's new band. They needed to hit the ground running when Big Brother ran its course. Skip moved to San Francisco, and they workshopped new material. It was late one evening, after a rehearsal session, that Skip saw the beefy figure approaching him outside the Fillmore. He was walking straight at Skip. It was eerily quiet. Soon there was another figure, and then another, and another. And they came from the shadows. For such big dudes, they were incredibly stealthy. Skip was surrounded on all sides by Hell's Angels in leather. Their faces were bearded and bruised. Some were missing teeth. One had a patch over one of his eyes. Skip tried to swallow, but his spit caught in his throat. "You Skip Prokop, the one with the gnarliest beard and biggest belly?" asked. Skip's hands shook. He tried to swallow again, but it was no use. He confirmed, in as few words as possible, that yes, he was Skip Prokop. The biker nodded. "You're gonna take care of our little sister, aren't you, Skip Prokop? You wouldn't want to go and do a stupid thing like not take care of our little sister, would you now, Skip Prokop?" Skip confirmed, again, in as few words as possible, that yes, absolutely, he was going to take care of her, or no, he didn't want to do stupid things. He thanked the angels for looking out for their little sister. His hands continued to shake. In 1969, however, Janice's problems would begin to multiply. She'd have to hide her drug habit from Grossman. Band members would go missing. They'd need to wear disguises, and not least because the FBI had Janice Joplin on a watch list. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. All right, this episode of the 27 Club is brought to you by Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I also host. Disgraceland is available only on the free Amazon Music app. To hear tons of insane stories about your favorite musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly, Nirvana, Prince, Jerry Lee Lewis, The Grateful Dead, The Rolling Stones, Cardi B, and many, many more, go to amazon.com/Disgraceland. Or if you have an Echo device, just say, "Hey Alexa, play the Disgraceland podcast." The 27 Club is hosted and co-written by me, Jake Brennan. Zeth Lundy is the lead writer and co-producer. Matt Bowden mixes the show. Additional music and score elements by Ryan Spraker and Henry Lunetta. The 27 Club is produced by myself for Double Elvis in partnership with iHeartRadio. Sources for this episode are available at doubleelvis.com on the 27 Club series page. Our previous seasons on Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison are available for you to binge right now wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please be sure to find and follow the 27 Club on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your shows. And if you'd like to win a free 27 Club poster designed by the man himself, Nate Gonzalez, then leave a review for 27 Club on Apple Podcasts or hashtag subscribe to 27 Club on social media. And we'll pick two winners each week and announce them on the Double Elvis Instagram page. That's at Double Elvis. Give that a follow. So get out there and spread the word about the 27 Club. You can talk to me per usual on Instagram and Twitter at DisgracelandPod. Rock and roll.
What's up for your ears?